Are you ready to become a better version of yourself, to become a leader in your personal and professional life? Then welcome to the CJ Evolution Podcast, where we put a twist on traditional criminal justice professions and provide you with the tools you need to set yourself up for success in your career and for the future. Now, welcome your host, the CJ Evolutionist himself, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to episode 265 of this great show we call CJ Evolution, and growing because of you, the listener and supporter. Thank you so much. Patrick here. I'm the host and creator. And one of the ways we continue to grow is through ratings and reviews. If you rate and review this great show, I sure would appreciate it. Head over to iTunes and leave a review. I sure would appreciate it. And we're also on Instagram now. You can check us out at CJEvolution_podcast. If you send me a message, I promise I will respond to you. Folks, you all know that I am partnered, or the podcast is partnered with Four Sigmatic, and we love this coffee company. You're going to love their products, and best of all, you're going to get 15% off using the promo code CJEV. You know, folks, I love having authors on the show, and I love this next author because he's talking about a very important topic that was the premise behind his book, and that is fixing our broken criminal justice system here in the United States. Now, I still think we have one of the best systems in the world. Just check out other countries out there. Maybe a handful of them have a good system like ours. Now, again, I know we have problems within our criminal justice system, but this next author is going to talk about some ways we can improve and possibly fix those problems. Enjoy the guest and the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have James Bolin on the show. He's a PhD, former cop, and he's got a great book out there. James, are you there, sir?
I am.
Well, thank you for being here. I know the first time, a couple weeks ago, we had some tech issues, but everything sounds great, James. So, again, I appreciate you being on the show. And can you tell the audience a little bit more about yourself, sir?
Well, I was born and raised in the city of Chicago, and I spent most of my life on the south side of Chicago. Mm-hmm. After graduating high school, I enlisted in the United States Marine Corps. I spent 2 years in the Marine Corps, came home, and started school at the University of Illinois at Chicago, where I majored in criminal justice. Mm-hmm. And later on, I ended up joining the Chicago Police Department.
Mm-hmm. They paid
for graduate school.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your service as a Marine. And thank you for serving as a Chicago police officer. I'm sure you have many crazy stories working in Chicago. Chicago's a huge city, like we all know. Now, how many officers does Chicago have? I know they're the second or third biggest in the country.
13,500.
Yeah, that's a lot of cops. So just a dumb question, forgive me, James, but when you're working for an agency that big, I mean, you don't know half the people, right? I mean, there's no way you can know 13,000 other cops. I mean, is my mom wrong or what?
You're exactly right. No, you don't know.
So you could show up on a call and be like, who are you? You know what I mean, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So at any given time, really quick, another dumb question, James, but at any given time when you were on the street, how many police officers were working your beat or your district or?
Oh, well, see, that'll vary depending on the size of the district. There are some, like, for example, where I worked, geographically, it was small as comparison to one of our neighboring districts. I worked in the 7th district. 8th district, geographically, is much bigger. So it all depended on which the 25 districts in which you worked.
So you could have, like, a half a dozen or a dozen cops working at one time, or
On the street at one time?
Yes, sir.
No,
yes.
Well, there'll be more than a dozen. None of the districts are that small.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. I can't imagine, man. And again, thank you for your service, serving in the great city of Chicago. So what made you want to become a police officer, James? I mean, you served with distinction. You were a highly decorated police officer for 15 years. What made James Bolin want to become a police officer?
I guess there are several factors. I will have always been drawn to matters involving criminal justice, the criminal court system. And I had two uncles that were Chicago police officers. So, and I got to, especially with one of them, I got to meet some of his partners over the year because he had, at one point in his career, he was assigned to the same district in which I lived. So I got to meet them, and I do have an altruistic nature. I like helping people.
That's pretty cool. Now, what made you say, I mean, I can't imagine working, for a big agency like Chicago PD, and I'm sure that there were pros and cons, but what was the catalyst that said, I'm gonna go on to other things, I'm gonna retire from law enforcement?
I left earlier than I wanted to. I had, due to some of the things that I did, well, one thing in particular, the largest street gang in the city of Chicago is the Gangster Disciples. And the GDs in our district really didn't like me a whole lot because of some of the things I did while I was policing. I took a lot of their money and cars and that sort of thing. I caused them a lot of trouble. And then I uncovered a situation where they were operating two used car dealerships in our district, and they were selling cars, used cars to people, and giving them temporary registration permits for the state of Indiana. And that doesn't work well. So after I investigated a little bit more, I learned that neither of those dealerships were had been licensed by the state. It's illegal to operate a car dealership in the state of Illinois without being licensed by the state. So long story short, I closed the dealerships down. I took all the cars, and the main point person that they had running both the agencies was convicted on 27 felony counts.
Jeez. So needless to say, they were a little ticked off at you.
They were a little bit angry with me, and it wasn't before I had been threatened a lot of different times during the career. That didn't bother me, but when we started getting anonymous phone calls to the police district threatening to kidnap my daughter,
Oh, geez.
that gave me the, so okay, I have to leave.
Well, I mean, of course, when it comes to, I mean, I'm the same way. I mean, you can threaten me, but when it comes to the family, that's another thing, because James, I mean, these gangs, these criminal organizations, I mean, they have some reach, man. They have some influence, and
Yeah,
they
just a little bit. And
get
see,
to
these
people.
guys too, they knew too much. They knew where she went to school. They knew her grandparents would pick her up every day after school. They knew where her grandparents lived. So I'm like, no, I think I should leave.
Do you ever get, just out of curiosity, do you ever get any threats, even where you're at right now, where you're living right now? Do you ever get any threats, or is that pretty much done?
That's done.
Okay. Now, do you miss anything about law enforcement? Do you miss any aspect of it, or?
There were some times during the course of my career that I genuinely got to help someone. And at that point in my career, I was a field training officer. So I had the opportunity to help mold and shape officers very early in their career.
Yeah,
And
that's so
that was
important.
enjoyable.
So important that they have good people like you molding them, because there is a level of corruption in law enforcement. And when they have good people that they're getting taught from at the beginning, that's huge, James. You know that. I mean, the FTOs are the most influential people outside sergeants and things like that. Those are the first exposure to the department, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's very, very important. Now I want to talk about your book, Fixing the Broken Thing, the American Criminal Justice System. It's everywhere. Books are everywhere, and we'll have it linked up in the show notes afterwards. I agree with you. There's a lot of things wrong with the criminal justice system. What was the catalyst? What was the reason you said, I'm going to put pen to paper, I'm going to write this book?
It had everything to do with my experiences during my policing career. I didn't, the book, the contents of the book has nothing to do with anything I got in the classroom.
Sure. It's
everything as far as my career policing. And I know that there are things that this system should do better than it does. So I decided that I would put pen to paper and offer my suggestions for what we can do to make it better.
What are some of the things, what are some of the big things you see? And maybe it's too broad of a question, but I'll ask anyway. So, you know, because I agree with you. I think there's some things that we're doing right, but I think we need to be doing a lot differently. What are some of the things, the big things, James, that you've seen? I know you talk about inequality in the criminal justice system. I agree. I know you talk about use of force issues and all the things that are the police officers are getting into. What's some of the big highlights that you think that we need to be improving on?
Well, initially, I would, my first impression, that's when I got into the police academy. And right off the bat, I was like, gee, there's really nothing too challenging about this. And I really believe that it should have been a heck of a lot more challenging based upon my training in the Marine Corps. The when I was going through the selection process, one thing that jumped off the page when we took the supposed to be psych exam is well over 300, the multiple choice tests, well over 300 questions. And basically it was a battery of about maybe 70 questions that they asked in two or three different ways. And from this, they were supposed to be able to glean insight into your character. Now contrast that to the methodology used in Marine Corps basic training, where they put you in consistently stressful situations over 3 months. And their idea is that under stress, your true character will surface.
I agree. Yeah,
so that was my first suggest. That was a heck of a lot. I think that's a heck of a lot better vehicle to use to determine, do we really believe these people should be, should advance and go on and become police officers?
That's an interesting, you know, I've never really thought about it that way, but I was in the Army, so it went through very, because you're right. I mean, in basic training, you know, you're being put into or thrown into, you know, stressful situations. I guess, how would you incorporate that? Because I agree. I think that's a great idea, because you really don't know the true nature of how somebody's going to react until they're put in that situation. You've heard it. We fall back to our training. How would you incorporate that into some sort of law enforcement training in the academy?
Use some of the same strategies that were used in Marine Corps basic training. From the very beginning, they told us, well, we were standing there on those yellow footprints at 1 o'clock in the morning. We were told, look to your left, look to your right. One of you will not be here at the end of these 12 weeks. And we will do everything, fair and unfair, to determine whether or not you packed the gear to serve in my beloved Corps. Translation. What the object is, we need to know that being a Marine is an awesome responsibility. We need to know whether or not your shoulders are broad enough to bear the burden of that responsibility.
Now, do you think, though, and I agree again, I mean, do you think that that would work with today's generation of law enforcement, you know, young cadets that are coming through? I agree with you. But could you do that today realistically with, you know, we live in a litigious society, people suing everybody. Do you think Chicago PD, not to pick on Chicago, but do you think they could get away with saying, you know what, Academy, you know what, cadets, you know, half of you are not going to graduate. I mean, my guess is people would be like, wait a minute, I'm gonna sue you. You know, you can't tell me that. You know what I mean? Or maybe I'm just reading too much into it. I agree it needs to be more stressful. But do you think we could get away with it? Because I think the military is one thing, you know. But do you think we would be able to get away with it as academy directors and stuff like that? to tell people that. Or I guess we just live in a society, and you correct me if I'm wrong, James, where everybody's just like touchy-feely, and we can't say things like that. You know what I mean?
This is, from all accounts, the most litigious society
yeah.
on the planet.
Yeah.
And I understand that implementation of this type of training would be arduous at
yeah.
best. However, I also believe the argument can be made that I remember the commercial. I forgot what the product was, but the mechanic was at the end was saying, you know, pay me now or pay me later.
I like that.
Okay.
I like that. Yeah, deal with it now or deal with it later on. I like that.
Right. And one of the things I quote in the book is an article I saw in the Wall Street Journal about the hundreds of millions of dollars municipalities have paid or are paying for issues of police misconduct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, now, how do you think, it's a great segue, great topic in there. I mean, you saw probably, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm assuming that you saw police misconduct when you were on the street in Chicago.
Actually, what I learned very early, mm-hmm. and it was as a recruit, I was working with my FTO, and we were involved in a chase. We chased some kids in a stolen car. So the kids stopped the car that took off running. And so we got several police officers chasing. So I caught one of the kids and walking him back to where the other cars were. And one of the veteran officers, I had not met him, didn't really know who he was. Mm-hmm. He ran over toward where I was with this kid in the handcuffs. He pulled out his flashlight and drew back as though he was going to hit the kid with the mm-hmm. flashlight. And I immediately pulled the kid behind me and said, that's okay, I got this. This
yeah,
is
yeah.
under control.
Yeah.
So when I made it to the car with my FTO, he told me that that was good. And now you have sent the message.
Mm-hmm.
So it will go throughout the district and everyone will know that if this is the type of stuff that you want to do, can't do it where this guy is or anywhere around him because he's not going to go along with it.
Yeah. And that's good. I mean, that is good, especially in when I think of what you just said, which was the right thing to do, obviously. I mean, it's almost like now you could have a target on your back, right? I mean, because you're going up against this veteran officer, and who are you to interrupt what I was going to do? And hopefully it wasn't going to do anything, but maybe. But I guess my question to you is, now after that incident happened, James, were you? I mean, you heard of Serpico, right? I mean,
I did.
Yeah, I mean, that's the image that keeps coming into my mind. So you got this good cop out there, i.e., you're standing up to the man, the system, this veteran police officer who's probably been beating up on people most of his career. Did you get any flack after that and say, look, I mean, because Chicago is a big city. I mean, it's a big police department. Did you get any flack for that or any blowback on the action you took, which was the good action?
That was an immediate concern, but after mm-hmm. talking with my field training officer, of course, he had been in the district for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, well, they already, that the guys there already knew that that's not something that he supported.
Good, yeah.
And he told me, you won't have that type of a problem, not here. So you're okay.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's good. Now, we talked a little bit about use of force with police officers. Do you think, you know, being a police officer for many years, you see the news today. Do you think that I'm still in law enforcement? Do you think that it's gotten better with use of force, excessive use of force, I should say? I mean, because there's always a use of force, but it doesn't mean it's excessive. Do you think it's getting better when it comes to excessive use of force out there?
I don't know. I don't know if we can say that it's getting better.
Or
even if it's getting worse.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure. What I advocate in the book, my what I advocate in the book, and I believe that what could help is, again, the type of training that I got in Marine Corps boot camp, because the primary thing that they did that helped me, and it was, I mean, a major emphasis, was that in emergency pressure situations, we want you to make decisions based upon rationale and not your emotion. They taught us and they drilled into us the fact that we had to divorce ourselves from the emotion and allow your rational mind to guide your actions.
I agree. So, but I would go a step further, and that's the kind of stuff that we should, the important kind of traits, you know, those personality traits that we should be looking for in applicants before they even come to the academy, right?
I would agree.
Yeah, we need to be looking for that.
I would agree. I would most assuredly agree. But even at that, there's only so much that you're going to find out about this person during when they take the written exams and when they pass the physical fitness test and et cetera. You're going to find out some. And you do a background check on them, you'll find out some things. But just as in Marine Corps boot camp, we find out everything once we have you there at MCRD San Diego or Paris Island.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's all good. Now, what do you think some of the issues are, James? I mean, you probably know people aren't flocking to law enforcement like they used to when you first got into this profession, sir, like when I did 23 years ago. People were just flocking, at least the impression I got. I mean, you know, you'd have an opening and there'd be like a ton of people showing up. What do you think some of the reasons are that people, because I think statistically the information's out there, people aren't getting into law enforcement and criminal justice. What do you think some of the reasons are?
I believe some of the reasons could be salary, pension benefits, working conditions. And the fact that there's, because one of the things that I advocate in the book is better use of the police explorers and junior police, where early on you can start grooming and training people that are interested in a possible career in law enforcement, start grooming and training them while they're teenagers.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, grooming the next generation and kind of, you know, I think, a lot of I shouldn't say a lot, but some departments don't have explorer programs. And I agree, you should be looking at succession planning and who's going to take those roles in the future. So, yeah, I agree with that. What are other some of the highlights, without giving away too much of your book? Well, I know, again, you talk about overburdened courts, you know, overcrowded jails, which is what you talk about, which I think is very important, mental health care and how the U.S. correctional system is becoming the mental health provider in this country. I mean, I want to use the word it's crazy because that's but it's unbelievable that we've come to the point where we have a huge mental health crisis out there, and the jails and correctional system are supplying that. At least somebody is, I guess. But what do we do when people get out of, you know, jail? How are we going to help them after they get out from being incarcerated? So you talk about so many important issues in this book.
That happened. I hit the rewind button, and it was in 1980 when Reagan took office, and he decided to kill the funding for long-term mental health facilities. And no president that followed him has addressed it. So the prison system has become the de facto long-term mental health facility.
Well,
that's just completely unacceptable.
And I don't know. I mean, you probably did, James, you were on the street. I mean, you came into contact with people who were suffering mentally with whatever they were. But it seems like it's we're getting calls to assist almost every day. And that's okay, because that's what we do in law enforcement. But what's the solution, man? Because it seems like it's just a circle. I'm a firm believer that we shouldn't be locking up everybody that has a mental health issue, and maybe they've been caught with drugs or whatever. We need to address the root issue. You know what I mean? Now, some people need to be in jail. I get that.
Yes.
But what do we need to – how do we tackle this mental health crisis? It's just – I don't know.
Well, we have to we have to reestablish the long-term mental health facilities. Mm-hmm. Now, there are several things in the book that I suggest that will cost a lot of money. Mm-hmm. They do, but again, without not giving away too much of the book, I also explain from where we can get the money to do these things.
Yeah, because like you said, I love your analogy when you were like, okay, do we want to deal with it on the front end? Do you want to pay for the repairs right now, or do you want to pay more in your repairs if you ignore it, which we've been doing, and now we're at a point where, holy crap. You know, when we should have been dealing with it from the beginning.
That tragically, that's where we are.
Mm-hmm. Well, if people want to reach out to you, sir, how can they do it? Social media, the website. I mean, how can they find James Bowen?
Well, they can find me on Facebook. I think my wife set that up. It's J-A-B-O. They can and also use my email address, which would be L like Lincoln, C like Charles, P like Paul, L like Lincoln, B like Bravo, O like Ocean, J like James, R like Robert at yahoo.com.
James Bowen, sir, PhD, fixing the broken thing, the American criminal justice system. And for all those listeners out there, it's at bookstores everywhere. It's online at Apple, iTunes Store, Amazon, Google Play, and Barnes & Noble. Sir, any parting thoughts before we leave?
I believe that we have the necessary tools to make this better. Mm-hmm. However, ladies and gentlemen, it's not going to get better unless we, the people, get off the sofa, put your hard hat on, and get involved. Our elected employees, I said that, I said what I meant what I said, employees,
our
elected employees, do not have the necessary motivation to do anything other than let's just go status quo.
Yeah, I agree. I agree,
they
sir.
They won't until we, yeah, again, treat them like employees.
Yeah, they work for us.
Employers.
They work for us. And they're spending our money indiscriminately the way they want to spend it. And we need to start spending more money on such an important aspect of our society, and that's the criminal justice system. Sir, anything,
yes,
we can do for you in the future, please reach out to me, James. We'll have, okay, a link up to your book, and much success to you in the future, sir.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Take care of yourself, James.
Okay, and a good day to you.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.